Good morning and welcome to Focus 580. This is our telephone talk program. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you listening this morning. In the first hour of the program today, we'll be talking with filmmaker Reggie Life. He has been involved in a number of different kinds of projects. He's worked on ethnographic documentaries. He's worked on feature films. This morning, we'll be talking specifically about three movies that he made that, among other things, lead one to think about how it is we think about race and ethnicity. One of them, I'll give the titles of one, is titled Struggle and Success, which looks at the experiences of African Americans who have chosen to live in Japan. It was shown here on the campus just a couple of weeks ago. He was here visiting. Perhaps people who are listening got the opportunity to see some of his movies. We were going to talk with him here on the program, and I was struggling with a bad cold that week, so we ended up having to reschedule, and he was good enough to say that he would talk with us, and we're doing it this morning by telephone. A little bit more information about our guest. Reggie Life was born in New York City. He studied film at New York University and cinema studies at Harvard before starting his career in film. He did do a number of ethnographic documentaries that were shown and honored at a number of film festivals, including those in Toronto and Montreal. He has done some work also in feature film. He worked on the film Ragtime and also Trading Places, that film with Eddie Murphy. He also produced and directed Reunion, a film that starred Denzel Washington, and also directed an acclaimed AIDS awareness film titled Seriously Fresh. He had the opportunity to go to Japan on a National Endowment for the Arts Creative Artist Fellowship, and he spent 6 months there, and that led him to produce his first work in Japan, which was this film, Struggle and Success, about the African-American experience in Japan. It was broadcast on NHK in Japan and also here on PBS. His second work related was Doubles, Japan and America's Intercultural Children. That film examined the experiences of children of Japanese and American parents going back, really, to the turn of the century and up to today. That also aired on NHK and on PBS in this country. And more recently, he has done a third documentary titled After America, After Japan, a film that chronicles the saga of re-entry for Americans and Japanese. So we'll talk a little bit about the work this morning, and, of course, questions are welcome. Again, perhaps there'll be some people listening who had the opportunity to see the films when they were shown. The questions are welcome, and the number, if you're here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. We also do have a toll-free line. That's good anywhere that you can hear us, and that is 800-222-9455. And if you match the numbers with the letters on the phone, you get WILL. So 333-WILL, toll-free, 800-222-WILL. Reggie Life, good morning.
Hi, good morning. How are you?
I'm fine, thanks, and thanks for talking with us.
Yeah, not a problem.
I really enjoyed, I had the opportunity to watch Struggle and Success and Doubles, and I think that they're really quite good. And as I said, I think that they're important because it does lead one to think about how it is we think about ethnicity and race, a subject that I think is very important and something that in this country we really need to be thinking about and talking about.
Yes, yes.
And also, although I think it's probably unfortunate, too, that documentaries are not, it's not easy to see documentaries. You can see them on public television. Occasionally, you can rent them and watch them, but I'm sure that this is also a frustration for people who make documentaries. I know, first of all, it's hard to get the money to make them, and secondly, to get it so that people can see them.
Yeah, it is a problem. It's become increasingly more of a problem as our public television system is moving towards network kind of thinking and network formatting of sort of strip shows and sort of if your show doesn't fit one of their established formats, being American Experience, American Masters, POV, or something like that, then you're sort of in this weird world of what they call a one-off, a single program. And unless the entire system wants to support it, then you're literally peddling your work from station to station. And there are more than 175 stations in the public television system of America. So you can see what a daunting task that can be for an independent filmmaker.
I have friends here who are documentary makers and have done some pretty good work. And it's sort of the same sort of thing. You put a lot of work into something, yeah, and we will show it. And then maybe if you're really lucky,
yeah,
you can get the network to pick it up. And the hope being that You know, it's not because it's going to make you rich, because right. but because you really would like people to see your work.
Exactly. But again, as you point out, it's very, very tough. I mean, the first two films did very, very well on NHK and PBS here because they were picked up as national broadcasts, which meant that all 175 stations could show the film. And in many cases, I think Doubles in particular was shown by more than half of the system nationwide. But again, the programmers are now basically more or less being run by the central authority out of Washington. And what's happening more times now is that their ability to kind of program their own stuff is being curtailed. And I think it's something that your listeners should know about, because, again, if you want to begin to see more independently produced work by American filmmakers, you're going to have to sort of demand that from your stations, because they're just taking the feeds that they're getting from the national system, and many times those feeds are not featuring the work of independents.
Yeah. I'd like to hear about how it is you happened to go to Japan, and obviously something about the experience grabbed you, and led you into doing these films.
Yeah, well, Japan was something that was on my radar for many years, going back, in fact, to high school. I had a classmate, and we both had a fascination about the East, and particularly Japan. She got there before I did. She went there right after college years and spent 3 years in Kyoto teaching English. But when she returned, she looked me up and hosted me for dinner one night and kind of told me all about her travels and showed me all the souvenirs. And it really, I guess, ignited a real fire under me at that point. And I think it was then I really started to pay more attention to Japanese cinema. And I used to go to a place in New York City and watch a lot of old Kurosawa movies and retrospective of Ozu and Naruse and Kinoshita and Mitsuguchi and people like that. And finally, as things will go, was at a little bit of a lull just in the professional work in New York and California. And someone who lived in my building in New York City had just come back from a year in Japan on the same fellowship that I went on through the National Endowment, and really kind of sold me on the idea of taking a little time off and sort of, you know, doing a project that I'd want to do. So I pitched this idea of actually working with a Japanese filmmaker who was still working in sort of the old style of producing movies in Japan. I lucked up and found probably the best person I could have ever found in 1990, who was a renowned filmmaker in Japan named Yoji Yamada. And he agreed to allow me to, you know, kind of observe the making of his Torosan epic. And it was quite an honor, because I was and have been the only foreigner, non-Japanese, ever allowed to witness the production from start to finish. And it was really, that's how I got there. I mean, I went over essentially to witness this film being made, and in some respects also to kind of experience Japan, of course. And I also have to thank him a lot for that, because he did not allow me to kind of come to Japan sort of and remain a foreigner while I was there. He arranged my housing, which was with a Japanese family, so I was basically forced to learn and speak Japanese all the time with them. Same thing happened when I was on the set with him and his crew. I mean, there was one sort of English speaker there, so my Japanese abilities had to move pretty quickly. And then, of course, when you're traveling, you know, every day from a little home somewhere to the studio on public transportation, you know, you become immersed in another world and another culture, and it was the best thing that could have ever happened for me. You know, most foreigners go to Japan and they live in these sort of what are called gaijin ghettos, sort of foreign little enclaves in Tokyo. And you can kind of avoid Japan, and you could be in Japan 20 years living like that and never learn anything beyond good morning in Japanese. But, you know, I really had a different experience, and it was really a real precious and real blessing.
Yeah. Let me introduce just real quick. Our guest is filmmaker Reggie Life. He grew up in New York. He's done ethnographic documentaries. He's worked on feature films. We're talking here this morning. We'll talk in some detail about movies that he made that came out of this experience he was just talking about, one being a film titled Struggle and Success, which looks at the experiences of some African-Americans who have decided to live in Japan, and the other film titled Doubles, which is subtitled Japan and America's Intercultural Children, which again looks at the experiences of children who had, most of them, I think, had American or Caucasian fathers, some African-American fathers, too, and Japanese mothers, many of them born after World War II, but some going back before. And both of his shows showed on Japanese television on NHK, that's kind of their PBS, and also nationwide here on public television. And he was here visiting the campus just a couple of weeks ago. Your questions are welcome. 333-WILL, toll-free, 800-222-WILL. In Struggle and Success, that you talked with a number of people, men and women, people who are in different occupations, whose experiences were different. So the picture is really subtle and complex. However, right at the beginning, I think one of the people that you talked to says that in going to Japan, and I think this was a woman, said that she felt, and maybe echoing the experiences of others, that something, I think she says, something we wanted that we hadn't gotten yet, and we found it here in Japan. What is that thing, and it was this a kind of sentiment that other people would have voiced too?
Yeah, I think going out of America, number one, is a chance to sort of see yourself as a world citizen, see yourself in the world at large. And I think for many African Americans, sort of envisioning our experience only through the American prism is extremely limiting. So I think for many people, that initial experience in Japan, which for many of them was kind of the only or first experience living outside of America, is a liberating one, because suddenly, you realize there are two things. There's one going on, yeah, the rest of the world kind of looks at you based on popular American imagery and stereotypes and media, and some of these things are often negative and extremely stereotyped. But at the same time, there is the opportunity to get to know people on a one-on-one basis, a kind of a heart-to-heart relationship, where you can then develop yourself as an individual. You are no longer, just relegated to this mailbox way of looking at people that we do in America, black person, white person, Asian person, that kind of thing, that therefore then limits you to walk in lockstep with every other member of your group with no regard to gender, class, economics, or anything. It's just a simple race-based identification. And I think that's what people are talking about when they first get there. And it's an undeniable experience that they all have. And again, how you then move from that understanding while you're in Japan really is what defines your experience there.
It is possible, and people do talk about dealing with discrimination on a couple of levels. On one level, because they are not Japanese, and it's the kind of thing that anybody who was not Japanese would deal with.
Exactly.
The other is discrimination based on the fact that they are black. And though, interestingly enough, people say different sorts of things, and again, the picture gets complex,
right?
That on the one hand, you might say someone say something like, being black in Japan offers a form of psychic freedom because you don't have to think about race every day. Well, someone said that. On the other hand, people did tell stories, for example, stories like facing discrimination when they went to rent an apartment. That
right.
They would call ahead, the person would say, oh, yes, the apartment's available, come on right over. And then when they get there and the person sees that they're black, then they say, the same thing. Oh, I'm so sorry, I made a mistake, somebody else.
The apartment is rented.
Apartment's already rented.
Yeah.
And then, of course, they find out later that, no, that's really not
the case.
Not the case.
Exactly. Yeah, and that is very much, again, an experience that you'll find there. And I'm glad you draw the distinction initially, because I think this is the prime overriding factor, is that it is a distinction between Japanese and non-Japanese. Mm-hmm. And in Japan, renting apartments, there are no laws against discrimination. So any person that wants to rent you an apartment can decide once they see you or even just talk to you on the phone whether they want to do that or not. There's no law there in Japan as we have here against that kind of thing. On the other hand, which is something I think that should be made clear, a lot of times, particularly in the people that were interviewed in the program, they are living in areas that are kind of what I would call foreigner friendly. These are Japanese that are used to renting to non-Japanese people. most who are business people and diplomats. And so they have discretionary income. These are not low-rent places. These are fairly high-rent places. Oftentimes what happens is the people that occupy the building, which are primarily Caucasian, either being Americans, Australians, or Europeans, essentially create an atmosphere of exclusivity with the building, whereas either directly or indirectly, they kind of let the landlord know that if you rent the apartment that becomes a vacant to another person, we'd sort of like someone like us to take it, if you know what I mean. Mm-hmm. So what ends up happening is, again, a lot of these things become, you know, learned behavior from the tenants, from the people who are occupying it, whereas the Japanese landlord doesn't want to upset the harmony in the building. And that becomes a very important thing in Japan, not upsetting things, not you know, pushing anything over, causing any chaos or dissension. So it becomes real easy for him to then look for only that kind of tenant that the rest of the tenants want to see in that apartment. You know, saying that, I should also say, too, there is a racial hierarchy in Japan, and there is, it's undeniable that at the top of the pyramid are white Americans or white Europeans, and then the pyramid goes down to maybe Australians and other people of a Caucasian race. And then as it goes down, you know, it fills out based on skin tone. Still, African Americans, because of the fact that we have Americans in our name, are further up on the pyramid than many other people of color. But there is a racial pyramid in Japan when it comes to foreigners, and there's a racial pyramid in Japan when it comes to the Japanese themselves. I mean, it's in Japanese history, it was always considered that those of lighter skin within Japan itself were considered much more higher class than people who were darker in complexion.
Is it, do you think, easier to be black in Japan than to be black in the United States?
Now that's a really tricky kind of question, and it's not a question I think that anybody could really answer. I don't think being a person of color is easier anywhere in the world. I think what Japan offers you as a person of color is that it offers you some time out from the kind of violent, life-threatening, dangerous racism that is present in America and also in Europe in places. I know very, very few stories of foreigners of color in Japan who've ever been threatened because of their color in a physical way, a violent sort of way. I mean, people may look at you, people may not like you because they perceive you as being a certain way because of the color of your skin, but they're not going to attack you. I think the situation is quite different in America, where even for myself as an African-American filmmaker traveling and doing speeches, I get invited to a lot of places, and it is often I have to, you know, sort of think twice about where I am going in America and making sure that I let my sponsors know that please pick me up at the airport, please take me back to the airport. If I want to drive somewhere, what is the best route to take so I can avoid any unpleasant experience? You understand what I'm saying?
Sure, sure. And in addition to this, the people that you talk to face a different kind of challenge, and that's the same kind of challenge that anyone who is not Japanese would face. And I think it's, at least what I don't know this from experience, but everything that I've always read says that the Japanese are famous for being wonderful hosts if
right.
you're a tourist. And if you're just going to go for a week or two, you're going to get the real treatment. However, if you show signs that you're going to stay for a while and that you're really going to, you're interested in trying to penetrate their culture, to learn Japanese, to settle in there, that they don't like. And they really, it's interesting that there's this, you use the word, there is this word gaijin, which is generally translated as foreigner. And I have also read that perhaps it has a different kind of shading, and that it doesn't just mean a person from another country. What it means is outsider.
Yeah.
And there is this very strong notion in Japan that there is us and there is them, and the gaijin are them.
Right. Right. No. You're quite right. I mean, if you examine the actual kanji or the actually Chinese writing the Japanese use for the word gaijin, it really translates outsider, and you're quite right. It is not just foreigner. Foreigner is a kind of a softening of what it means. It does mean outsider, and being an outsider in Japan is a very serious thing. not only for people who are not Japanese, but even for Japanese themselves being perceived that way by their own countrymen. So, yeah, you're right. The experience for most people who stay there for a long time beyond that visitor stage, that guest sort of status, is one of eventually you really, you know, if you're honest with yourself, you realize that no longer does your color and nationality really mean anything in Japan. You are an outsider. And as an outsider, you are going to, you know, be subject to a lot of perhaps discriminatory and not such nice treatment. And it's been interesting to me, again, in traveling in Japan, that usually only in confidence will, you know, Europeans or Americans or Australians confess to me that many of the things that happen, that you see happening in struggle and success to African Americans, have happened to them as well.
It seems in some interesting ways to cause the people who have had this experience to think about who they are, what their identity is, because I think someone says something to the effect of being in Japan really lets you be who you are, because obviously you can't be Japanese.
Right.
So you end up having to really, really be who – there's no way to not be who you are.
Yeah.
And also, that though that may create an additional pressure, because again, I think some of the people that you talked to said that they feel pressured to be an example, not just an exemplary American, but an exemplary African American. That is, and that's a lot of pressure to face, to,
sure,
to sort of be feel that you are representing,
yeah,
all African Americans somehow.
Right, right. No, no, no. There is a pressure. You're right. I mean, you become, in fact, an ambassador of your country. And for African Americans, again, this becomes more complicated in that you are not an ambassador for just African Americans. You're mostly an ambassador for Americans. And a lot of times, African Americans don't think of themselves as first Americans and then something else that America wants to define you as being. And so that becomes, as you say, a stress or a pressure, or in some respects can be also liberating when, again, suddenly you can think of yourself in a way that you haven't had a chance, but I think also begins to cause you as an African-American to redefine your position in this society and redefine what it is to be an American, and from a cultural perspective, no longer a race-based way of thinking, but looking at it in terms of what is American culture? What is it that all of us as Americans, regardless of race, do and think and practice? We often don't think about that in the American experience. It's not a conversation that comes up. We talk about race a lot, but we never talk about culture, or rarely talk about culture.
Some of the people that you talk to seem to be inclined to... they would say that this was a good experience for them. They were glad to have it, to be able to live in Japan for perhaps a number of years. But then it seemed that they knew that they would not live there forever. Other people actually did settle there. There were some men who fell in love with and married Japanese women and had children and looked like they are going to stay in Japan. What sort of makes the difference, do you think, between the people who decide really to settle in Japan and those who would say, well, this is a good experience, interesting for some period of time, but eventually I know I'm going to go back to the United States?
Yeah, it's a very interesting question. I don't know if I could really answer that. You'd probably have to talk to somebody who's, you know, who specializes in kind of looking at those things. I mean, the only answer I can give you is this. I think that, and Donald Ritchie, who's a very famous writer who's been in Japan now for 52, 53 years, made an interesting statement. He said that when you stay in Japan for a long time, you realize you have to belong to something or someone. That Japanese society and culture really functions in that way of belonging, even for the outsider, even for that foreign person that's there. So I think the people that choose to stay open themselves up to belonging. And belonging can sometimes mean a company kind of belonging within your company environment, and that becomes your family. Or, and again, taking the personal step through marriage to belong to the society and be a kind of participating member. And I think the ones that basically don't open themselves up to that, you know, for whatever reason, whether it's just they haven't mastered the language and feel they never can, or, again, they find it comfortable to be an outsider, you know, in that society. Really, you know, and then they enjoy that status. I think those people, again, they enjoy that status up to where the enjoyment starts to wane, and then they leave.
We are about midpoint here through this hour, Focus 580. I probably should introduce again our guest. We're talking with filmmaker Reggie Life. He grew up in New York. He studied film at New York University and cinema studies at Harvard before going on to a career in film. He's made ethnographic documentaries. He's worked in feature films. He worked on the film Ragtime and also Trading Places. And he has made some interesting documentaries based on this material here we've been talking about. After his opportunity to go on a fellowship to Japan and get interested in Japan and Japanese culture, that led him to produce these films, Struggle and Success, the one we've been talking about here that looks at the experiences of African Americans living in Japan, then Doubles, Japan and America's Intercultural Children, and the third, After America, After Japan, which chronicles the saga of re-entry for Americans and Japanese. He was here visiting the campus a couple of weeks ago, and we didn't get a chance to talk with him when he was here, but we're glad to have him here on the show by telephone. And again, questions welcome. Maybe some people who saw the movies that we're talking about and you have questions or comments, you can give us a call. 333-9455. We also have a toll-free line, good anywhere that you can hear us, and that is 800-222-9455. One of the couples that you talked with in Struggle and Success, interesting because there is an African-American woman who is a college professor in Japan, was married to a Japanese man, but this was a man who was not born in Japan. He was born in Brazil, and then when he was, I think, a boy, went back to Japan, or was it that he didn't?
Yeah. Again, there is the largest Japanese population outside of Japan is in Brazil, and he grew up in Brazil. His father was a business person there, and then after the war was over, he, like many Japanese, repatriated, and so which is the thesis of my third film, a return experience back to his home country that he had never known because he had been born in Brazil. But it also, I think, instilled in him an early understanding of what it is to be an outsider in Japan. Mm-hmm. Ultimately, it led him to spend his university years in the States, where he met his prospective wife, who is African-American, while they were both in school in Chicago. Mm.
And they have a son, and this perhaps leads us into the next subject matter of the next film, who says that there were certainly times when he didn't feel accepted either by Japanese kids or by Western children, that he wasn't really quite sure where he fit in.
Right. Yeah, his Keelan Suzuki is an interesting guy. And matter of fact, he was Keelan when we made the program, and subsequently we were making Doubles. He had changed his name to use his Japanese name, Akiyoshi. So without knowing which one he's using right now, I'll say Akiyoshi / Keelan Suzuki is a very interesting young man. I mean, he because he is visibly dark complexed because of his mother, but his features are noticeably Japanese. You know, he appears to most Japanese in that culture as someone who is a double, or in some Japanese use the term hafu, which means half. And for him, again, it became a very much a double-edged sword. You know, yeah, in his community, which is a fairly upscale community in Tokyo, where there are other kids like himself, because he is darker in complexion, he is more noticeable than the other kids who might also have a mixed parentage. So yes, so he would have discrimination leaving his home, going to school sometimes. And then ironically, within the school environment, what you get is you get, again, a kind of a breakdown of when the kids play and when they socialize. So at those recess hours, the foreign kids all kind of group together and the Japanese kids all kind of group together. And then when the foreigners group, then you get the same kind of stratification hierarchy that you get kind of here in America, where the foreign kids of European or American heritage consider themselves the leaders and sort of top members of the class. And the kids of color, you know, are sort of meant to be in some way subordinate. So that's really where kind of Keelan's experience kind of sprung from. And it was a very, you know, tough time for him for quite a while, and the parents wrestled with where he should school and how he should school. So he he did some education in a sort of a Japanese private school, and that was okay. And then he, because of these sort of hierarchical things he was experiencing, he wanted to try Japanese school. So for a while, they actually put him in a Japanese school. But then that was really hard, not only just in terms of, again, really feeling like an outsider, but also academically. It presented other difficulties. So when I last spoke to them, Keelan was studying actually in the States now at a private school here in America. And I think he had found some adjustment, you know, leaving Japan and finding himself in a little more of an international environment with other kids like himself that had grown up outside of America. And in fact, that became his community, the kind of a global way of seeing himself probably for the first time.
Mm-hmm. In the second film, there's a lot of discussion about the idea of multiple identity. And late in the film, it seems that it's a term that's used by younger people. There are even some children who use this term double, and that is when they are thinking about, well, who am I, and trying to fit themselves into some particular category. Then they come to the understanding, or maybe someone tries to give them the understanding that, well, you don't have to do that. Mm-hmm. You can have multiple identities. And is, in fact, double a term that that people do use to describe people who are multi-ethnic?
Well, I wouldn't necessarily use the term multi-ethnic. I mean, I think that double springs out of Japan, and it was a term to really talk about intercultural, talking about kids who have an American culture and a Japanese culture. That's what the word double springs from. I know that in America now, with the new census, we are kind of experiencing this sort of people designating themselves in a multiple way. And again, generally those things, when listed on the census form, are kind of, again, race-based and ethnicity-based distinctions. Double really is looking at culture. It's really looking at the fact that these young people, and some are older people, have had the experience of two cultures. And that's how they're seeing themselves as an individual who has an American culture and as an individual who has a Japanese culture, and respect for both of those cultures. It's not necessarily race-based or ethnicity-based at all. And I think in with respect to most of these people in the interviews that we did, most of them don't even look at it through that prism of race or ethnicity. They're really looking at it through a culture, cultural perspective.
Well, there seems to be a lot of interesting blending going on, and people trying to acknowledge and celebrate all of these various cultures. There was striking there one man who was whose mom was Japanese and whose dad was African American said that in his house a typical dinner would be chicken teriyaki, rice, cornbread, collard greens, and black eyed peas.
Yeah. You know, food is the way it's probably the best way to sometimes celebrate, you know, kind of a mix of things in an intercultural way of life. Yeah, it's a great comment. It's a great thing in the film when he says that. But so many people talked about those kind of things, you know, that was the way in many respects that the parents first learned to communicate with each other was through food and through the American, you know, partner experiencing, you know, the food of the wife, and then the wife experiencing the food of the husband, and then bringing up their children, sort of, you know, celebrating this sort of culinary aspect of both cultures.
The one subject you deal with in this movie, and also actually in Struggle and Success, because in that movie too, you talk with some African Americans who have married Japanese, and natural question is, you know, how do your families feel about this whole thing? Here, dealing with the same sorts of thing, that did seem that there was a lot of adjustment required. Eventually, it seems that most cases families seem to come around, but initially, it seems to be a pretty tough thing, particularly for the Japanese. The idea that one of their daughters would marry someone who was not Japanese.
Right. Yeah, see, I think, you know, it's not limited to just African Americans. Again, I think the whole notion, and when a Japanese decides to marry a non-Japanese person, there is a lot of tension and a lot of, you know, uneasiness about that. I think, again, when we're looking at it from the American perspective, because we're looking at everything from a race-based way, we always assume that the darker person is going to have a harder time than the lighter person. And oftentimes what ends up happening is that, and I know this from, you know, Caucasians who have married Japanese, is even if they have problems, they can't talk about it because no one assumes they're going to have any problem. Whereas the African-American or the person of color who marries a Japanese, everyone assumes that the parents were standing at the door with a sword in their hand when they came, you know, to pick up the their wife or their husband or something like that. And again, it's exactly the opposite. You know, any time a Japanese person wants to marry a person who's non-Japanese, there is trouble. And the trouble escalates from just harsh words to who knows what. And it happens regardless of race, because, again, many times the Japanese may see race because, again, it's going to be visible if the American is a darker American or a lighter American. Maybe that's going to register some kind of value judgment in terms of how they think their son or daughter will be treated. But bottom line is this man or woman is non-Japanese, and that's really the source and root of all the problem.
Yeah. A lot of these, the people that you talk to, their parents, their fathers were American servicemen who were in part of the occupation after World War II, married Japanese women, and then they all came back to live in the United States. And also in a lot of these families, though, it seemed to be very important to the parents that the children knew their Japanese heritage, spent time in Japan, spent time living with and getting to know the Japanese side of their family. But again, it seems to be a sort of a difficult thing to figure out who you are, where you are. One woman, and this was a woman whose father, I think, was Caucasian, was European American, said, who went back and forth a lot, said whenever she was in when she was in Japan, there was all a lot of questioning about, well, who was she? Was she Japanese? Was she American?
Right.
And she said that there was a lot of pressure on her, sort of expectation, because her mother was Japanese, that she was expected to know how to be Japanese socially, what was always the right thing to do, because her mother was Japanese.
Right,
and
right.
At the same time, her relatives, some of her close female relatives, sort of told her right out, you will never really be Japanese.
Right, right, right.
So there was this very strange sort of set of conflicting pressures and identities, yet that on one hand she was expected to know the right thing to do, and yet on the other hand there was this thing that was said, was, well, really though, you're not Japanese, you're not ever going to be Japanese.
Right, right, right. Yeah. I mean, you hit it right on the head. I mean, yeah, everyone who has a Japanese parent is expected to know about the ways of Japanese people and all the etiquette and the things. And this happens even to Japanese Americans who could be third and fourth generation who speak no Japanese at all and who are really Americans culturally. But when they go back to Japan, they are expected to be as Japanese as a Japanese person who grew up there. And yet, again, you will, as you say, which is very painful to get it from your own immediate family, this sort of, well, forget it. You can never be like us because you didn't grow up here and you didn't go through the same things we went through. So it is, yeah, it's, again, it's a very much a double-edged sword for individuals like that who are by, you know, intercultural and have to face, you know, those sort of two extremes in Japan.
We have about 10 minutes left in this part of Focus 580, talking with filmmaker Reggie Life. He's done a number of films. He's worked on features. He's done ethnographic documentaries. And the movies here we're talking about are Struggle and Success, that look at the African-American experience in Japan. And the other is Doubles, Japan and America's Intercultural Children. And if you have questions, you can call in 333-WILL, toll-free 800-222-WILL. I was really struck by the story that of the people that you talked to in the film told. This is a woman who now lives in the United States, a woman whose mom was Japanese and whose father was Caucasian. So she's half Japanese, and she married a Caucasian man, and they have a little boy, and an impossibly beautiful little blonde little boy who is one quarter Japanese. But again, he's interested in his Japanese heritage, so are his parents, and it's funny because she says that he talks about being an undercover Japanese.
Right.
And that leads into some interesting thinking about And that's really the open question that you pose at the end of this movie, I think, is just where things are headed in the way that we think about race and ethnicity, and whether, in fact, we are headed towards a kind of a blending that we wouldn't have seen in the past.
Right, right. Yeah, I mean, I think that's very much, you know, as you say, an open question, and really one I think we all need to think about and just do some self, research, because we are undercover something. I don't think there's anyone living in America who is pure anything. I mean, our the history of this country, from the Mayflower through slavery right up to here, has created mixes, and many of us, again, don't even know what the mixes are anymore. We don't keep track of our family trees, with the way that the Japanese and some other cultures do, where they know everybody that married everybody. I mean, some people in America do, but most don't. So who's to say that you, the moderator of this show, might have a percentage of your bud that is not Caucasian or not whatever, what I mean? Mm-hmm. Maybe you've got some African-American or Native American in you. I know I have Caucasian blood in me because of the legacy of slavery. And so the idea that these people are trying to put forward with this is that let's begin to change the discussion and change this whole concept of who we are as not only Americans but people in the world from a race-based one, which is fraught with just continuing the madness that we currently live in, to one that looks more at culture and looks more at the idea of all of us as human beings, regardless of all these little nuances that either make you better or worse in someone's eyes.
Yeah.
And that's really where that's coming from. I mean, that whole thing of being an undercover Japanese and looking at this young man with blonde hair and blue eyes and saying, come on now. But it's true. He knows his heritage, and it's up to him now to carry that forward. And many of us need to take time to really know who we are, because oftentimes, again, what divides us in America is, in fact, we are the pot calling the kettle black. You know what I mean?
Mm.
That we are hating someone who is, in fact, our brother and sister if we took the time to really know who we are as Americans. And so, again, that's why I tend to try to get people, when they view these programs and when they use these in educational institutions, as a catalyst to get people to begin to think outside the box and to begin to look at ourselves in a much larger context, because we are more than what often is talked about, and it's time that conversation start to really generate some acceleration and heat. So I'm happy that you picked up on that, because it's many times people watch Doubles, and I don't say they miss that point, but they don't get it in the way that you got it, and I really appreciate the fact you picked up on that.
Sure. There's one thing I think that's guaranteed to lead a person to think differently about the place they live, and that is having the opportunity to live for an extended period of time someplace else.
Yeah.
Particularly if it's someplace that culturally that's really different from what you grew up in.
Yes.
When you, and this, I want to at least talk a minute or two about the third movie, when you had the opportunity to talk to people who had done that, I guess I'm particularly curious about whether you were able to follow up with some people who had lived in Japan and then come back to the United States, how they felt that they had been changed by that experience, or whether they felt they had been changed by that experience.
Yeah, well, everyone has changed. I mean, and I think that is the most upsetting and exhilarating and triumphant part of living away and then coming back is that, yeah, when you come back, you are changed. The America that you knew when you left, you froze in your mind, whatever year that was, whatever was going on here, you froze it. And then you come back 5 years, 10 years later, and that America no longer exists, and the American behavior and the way Americans interact has also changed. So no one who comes back can ever just fit right in again, and those that attempt to do that find very soon that they begin to trip up and they begin to sort of make mistakes, because you've been gone, and you're really not in sync with the rest of the world right now. So, no, everybody has been changed by it. And I think the people that I interviewed, what they tried to look at, just one second, sir.
Oh, sure.
Excuse me, I've got somebody at my door here.
That's okay.
You know, what they try to look at it in a positive kind of way, as opposed to, again, looking at the negative things that can happen from being away like that, but trying to say what they've gained from that experience in Japan, you know, what that Japan experience gave them in the way of new ideas about themselves, again, as a citizen of the world, not as this sort of, you know, American, Black American, White American, Asian American, whatever that, again, that mailbox kind of concept is that we often assign to people here. But I think that that's what they take from the whole thing, that the change, though maybe uncomfortable at first, becomes one where they, you know, they say, my God, look at who I realize that I really am in the context of our globe, you know, not just this American, you know, prism that we're always examining ourselves through.
So are there other ways in continuing projects that you're exploring the same themes?
Well, you know, there's some new projects that are currently in development that I'm looking at right now. Nothing is really, you know, settled in concretely yet where I could say, oh, the next one is going to be about this, that, or the other. But I think that these three films have led me, not only as a filmmaker, but also as a person, to a new way of examining our world. And what I'm looking forward to doing in some new future films is looking at other cultures and other places where people are questioning, you know, identity, questioning culture, questioning things that need to be questioned. I want to, you know, try to bring some attention and some light to those, you know, those struggles and those, those tasks that are being performed.
Well, I want to thank you very much for talking with us. I certainly appreciate it. I'm sorry we didn't get a chance to get you when you were here, but I'm real pleased that you could take the time to talk. And I think that they're fine films, and I would certainly recommend to people if you can find them to see them. Struggle and Success, the African-American Experience in Japan, Doubles, Japan and America's Intercultural Children, and the third is After America, After Japan. Read Your Life, thanks very much for talking with us.
Thank you, and thanks for the great questions.